right, we ready to roll? Got your notes pulled up?
Yeah. Oh, hey, just before we get started, let me go ahead and get a sip of coffee out of my I'm Your Huckleberry mug.
Pulling the mug back out on our first attempt at a video episode. So, yes, welcome to History and Film. This is just kind of right in the middle of our American History series, but this is the first episode we're going to try to also simulcast on YouTube here to see if we can extend our reach. So, yeah, we're talking about the 1988 film, 8 Men Out, which I am super excited to talk about. Logan had not seen this movie before. It is one. I grew up watching this movie as a kid, so I was a little nervous about rewatching it to see, because maybe it wouldn't hold up. Sometimes you look at those old movies you loved as a kid and realize, oh, yeah, that's not as good as I remember. But I would say overall it does hold up pretty well. My only real issues were like with the pacing. It just feels like way, way too much story to try to cram into a movie. But what did you think about 8 Men Out, first time seeing it?
I really liked it. Yeah, this was my first time watching it. It did seem like it was kind of, not necessarily skipping over a lot, but kind of, yeah, like you said, the pacing is a little difficult because of how much stuff actually happens. And in reading about the real life story, they also had to leave out a lot of stuff and kind of condense and decomplicate some stuff because it's a lot more detailed, the actual event, than what's shown in the movie. It's kind of pretty simplified for the purposes of trying to cram it all into a two-hour film.
Right, which we always talk about. History is way more complicated and nuanced. But this is another great example of a story that I think would be way better as like one of those limited series. If you did like a 10-episode thing, or maybe even more. I mean, this could be multiple seasons, or just where you can do a whole episode on here's Eddie's background, here's Buck's background, here's the gambler's background, and just do like a super, super deep dive into all these people. I think that'd be, and with this, because the vibe is cool. I like the early, you know, the early 20th century vibe we get from it. It's a lot of fun. And I always, and again, so this has extra nostalgia factor for me, you know, comes out in 1988. So I'm probably 10 years old when I first see this movie. So I'm basically the kid on the stoop saying, "Say it ain't so, Joe." Like, that was me when I'm first watching this film. Like, I was that kid. And on Rotten Tomatoes, this is an 87/80, very respectable. No Oscar nominations, however, but I also don't feel too indignant about that. Like, I really don't know what I would go to bat for as far as saying, like, oh, I can't believe it didn't get X nomination, because it's maybe not quite there, even though I do really enjoy it.
The only one that I would maybe consider, or maybe say is Oscar worthy, is John Cusack's performance.
Yeah, there you go. He could get a, yeah.
And honestly, maybe even not necessarily for a leading role, but maybe as a supporting role. Because,
and that's the trick right there, I think, right?
There isn't really a main character. I mean, you could make the argument that he is the main character because
it's a supporting performance in a leading role, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But I think the thing that sold me on, I mean, his performance is good for the whole movie, but that monologue that he has towards the end where he's talking to the kids after the trial, where he talks about the feeling of,
yes,
of like being in the groove and hitting a baseball in a Major League Baseball game.
Right, chills.
Like,
yeah.
That was so good. And it, man, I love me some sports movies, and I know you do too, obviously. Yeah, that monologue, it's like, I got goosebumps. I have goosebumps now, even just thinking about it. Like, it's that good.
Okay, that's awesome to hear. Yeah.
So I would say that I think his performance is probably Oscar worthy.
And the director is John Sayles, and I'm 95% sure he is the sports writer in the film who says, like, "You lied to me, Eddie," when he's kind of like realizing Eddie's throwing the games too, and the one that sings the song that like he's basically talking about them throwing the series at the end.
Oh, that's the director?
That's the director. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Unless I'm mistaken. Like, he pulled up the picture of the actor, or the director, you know, nowadays, 30 years later on IMDb, or on Wikipedia, his picture there. I'm like, oh, that looks like that actor who was the sports writer. So I'm pretty darn sure. Oh, so another little nostalgic thing. So this whole project is, you know, going through, looking up the historicity of movies here and trying to put them on a timeline. Right now we're doing American History, like I said. But it didn't occur to me until after watching the movie again and getting ready to talk to you about it that in some ways, this is the first movie that I ever researched the history of. Because I did a paper on Eight Men Out for Mr. Hebert's freshman English class, where I did exactly what we're doing and submitted it as a paper for Mr. Hebert, where I talked about Eight Men Out.
Oh, that's cool.
And like did the research and all that.
Yeah, that's cool.
I was digging it last night. I was seeing if I could find the paper, and I couldn't find it. Actually, I found the paper I wrote about Roberto Clemente junior year, but I couldn't find my mm-hmm. Eight Men Out Black Sox scandal from freshman year.
Since you brought him up, shout out Mr. Hebert.
Yeah.
He was actually, for people who don't know, he was both of our English teacher in high school, freshman and junior year.
Yes, yes. One of the teachers that was there for both of us. Yep, yep. Yeah, big shout out Mr. Hebert. Yeah, but I think he's a Yankees fan, you know, so whatever. No, I'm not actually a very big baseball fan, but I've always been fascinated by baseball history. And probably, honestly, growing up with movies like The Natural, Eight Men Out, Field of Dreams, we'll talk about here a little bit today, too, because it deals with the Black Sox scandal. And, you know, Roberto Clemente, reading about him in Sports Illustrated and reading a biography on him and just becoming a big fan of him after the fact. Obviously, he died before I was born. But I've always been, I just really like the nostalgic, or almost like the Americana nostalgia of baseball history. And so even though I don't watch baseball, it's boring, I like the idea of baseball and its kind of mystique with and how it ties into the history of America. So a little bit of background heading into our story today. Again, we're kind of glossing over a lot of things here, but we've talked about professional sports before too with Jim Thorpe and some other things. But so as far as the major is, and actually, I'm not sure we say MLB. It's like with the NFL, you say the NFL. With the MLB, do you say the MLB or just MLB? Because it seems weird to say the Major League Baseball. But
I don't know. I usually if I'm referencing it like as the acronym, I will say the MLB. Yeah. Which I know if you spelled it out would be weird because it'd be the Major League Baseball, which is strange. But I use it just in the same way that I would the NFL or the okay. NBA or the NHL. But a lot of times, though, you can like change your sentence structure such that you don't have to say it at all. And a lot of times, you won't even see it. Like it'll just be written out as Major League Baseball,
right? Right.
Or just said Major League Baseball instead of MLB.
All right. Well, that professional sports organization does it considers, as far as its own history goes, it considers 1869 the first year of professional baseball in the United States. Although that kind of predates the MLB itself, which goes back to the merger of the National Leagues and the American Leagues in 1903, not too dissimilar from the NFL-AFL merger in 1970, thereabouts. So 1903, that does make it the oldest professional sports league in the world. And as we're going to get into here, they initially set up a four-man or three-man and a secretary commission to administer the league. And that seemed to actually be mostly fine. There was a few, you know, controversial rulings, but nothing outside of the ordinary. A little bit of conflict of interest because they would choose, you know, owners to be commissioners for terms or whatever. But as we'll get to here, they kind of just after this Black Sox scandal just needed a clean slate and bring in an outsider just for public perception. And that's why we get into Kennesaw Mountain Landis here later in the film, and we'll talk about him. One person they did consider, though, was President Taft. Former President Taft was considered to be, I don't know if they ever actually offered it to him, but his name was thrown out there.
So I thought that Major League Baseball, that the organization MLB didn't come around until later. And that technically there's no merger. Like the National League and the American League are technically separate leagues. They just both fall under the purview of Major League Baseball.
Is it not actually structured the same way as the NFL? It's not an official merger.
It's not the NFC-AFC thing where there's an actual merger. They're technically still separate leagues, which is why you have differences in rule sets between the two.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Which is why, so you have the National League, the American League, but then the concept
right.
of Major League Baseball, which is why it is kind of different.
Right.
Okay.
And the, that, not merger, but that organization where the National League and the American League both recognized MLB and the commissioner of baseball as the, you know, top dog of professional baseball in the United States, that happened in 1920. So actually this 1919 World Series was the last World Series played not under the purview of Major League Baseball.
Wait, so what happened in 1920 that you said signified that?
The creation of MLB and the Office of Commissioner of Baseball happened in 1920.
Commissioner of Baseball, yes, and they did switch away from the dead ball era, and it did make some significant rule changes heading into 1920, but they agreed to join under the MLB in 1903.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm mistaken in that.
And actually, I'm reading here, too. It says, as far as you saying, yeah, they were separate organizations, it says here in 2000, 23 years ago, they did merge into one organization. So actually, maybe even though we have the separate rules, they are now considered one thing. But just since 2000, to your point.
Oh, okay. I'm looking at it now. Yeah, it says that they were dissolved as legal entities. And so now MLB is basically the same thing as an NFL.
But more recently than I thought. Like just 23, just in the year 2000.
Yeah, I didn't realize that that was the case at all. I thought they were still technically separate entities. They just both fell under MLB.
Gotcha.
Look at that. Learning on air.
Learning on air. And a good example of how history is definitely complicated. And I meant to research a little bit the dead ball era, which is basically the pre-1920 stuff. And actually, we get a hint of that in the movie because one of the guys shows Eddie the new ball they're thinking about using. And that would be
right.
Ending the dead ball era. And I think the idea is that pre-1920, dead balls just didn't go as far. Home runs were really hard to hit. And that's why you get Babe Ruth in the 20s hitting all these home runs and breaking all the records. It was also a new ball that was easier to hit out of the park. Not that, I mean,
right.
Ruth was still dominant compared to everyone else. And we're not really going to talk about him today. But before that was the dead ball era, a very pitcher heavy era, which is when you get into someone like Ty Cobb hitting how he did. It was very impressive because the ball was hard to hit.
Well, that's something that baseball is famous or in some ways infamous for, is changing rules to make it more entertaining or more watchable or, more accessible.
I mean, the NFL does that too. I mean, honestly, it is ultimate entertainment. So I don't really fault them for that. Like, I mean, NFL has moved.
No, I don't either.
Scoring, forward passing. Yeah, it's. I think the. Of course, yeah. It's why is soccer not caught on to that? sorry for our soccer fans out there. Yeah. So post World War One, baseball's popularity was starting to skyrocket. We've talked before about how sports were getting more and more popular. Gambling is kind of always a part of it, but you also needed the perception that it was clean. So as their popularity is soaring, this gambling stuff hits a peak with today's story, and they really, really just do need to hit reset, and we'll get to that. So before this story, again, this is about the 1919 White Sox getting paid by gamblers to intentionally throw the World Series. That did really happen, although again, it is more complicated than just that sentence would make it seem. But this wasn't the first time gamblers had attempted to insert themselves in professional sports to alter the outcome for their benefit. It was just the biggest. So it's almost like it was always happening. There were stories here and there. They're talking to the manager when he's on the stand later at the trial. And he's like, yeah, you know, I heard rumors. Like, it was going on, but this was the biggest example.
And not only that, this wasn't even the first time that the Chicago White Sox were involved in one of these scandals either. Which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, why don't you start with the gambler side of this? Like, how do the gamblers approach the team, and why don't you approach things from the gambler side of things?
Okay, so in the film, the most corrupt player on the team is Chick Gandil. So he's in the movie. He's played by Michael Rooker. So I'll start with him, and then kind of talk about a little bit about Arnold Rothstein, who is the guy who's putting up the money. Chick Gandil was born in Minnesota in 1888, and then moved to California at the age of 12. He played years of high school baseball before playing in semi-pro leagues in Texas, Arizona, and Mexico. At the same time, he was also working in copper mines and boxing for extra money while he was playing baseball, which he does kind of talk about a little bit at the beginning of the movie. He talks about being in
yeah.
in some boxing fights, which is true. He did box and work in the mines. And that's something that is interesting about like these early sports movies. We talked a little bit about it with Jim Thorpe, and it's the same case with these guys. They were not getting paid what we would consider, you know, professional athlete money today.
Right. It's not about even yeah. Inflation aside, it was just not as lucrative of a profession. Yeah.
Right. Right. I think they were saying that Eddie Seacoat was making the equivalent of like $50,000 adjusted for inflation.
Right.
Which is crazy to think about.
Right. So that's a good job, but like you're not a millionaire.
Not even close. Yeah.
Right.
So Chick gets his start, or almost gets his start, in the major leagues in 1908 when he gets drafted by the St. Louis Browns. But then he fails to make the team. I guess it was not really necessarily drafted like the way we would think of it today. It was more like you get a chance to come try out. But he didn't make the team. Ends up going back to California and playing in what they called an outlaw league, which is like a league that is not associated with Major League Baseball, so not one of the big leagues. But I think it is still technically professional baseball because he wasn't doing anything else at the time.
Okay.
But he got arrested for stealing money from a team in Fresno that he was playing for.
Huh.
In 1910, he plays his first game for the White Sox, ends up making it to the major leagues, but he has not a very good season and ends up getting traded to a team in Montreal. He was traded back and forth to various professional teams before returning to the White Sox in 1917. And this is where I said, you mentioned that, oh yeah, you know, there had been previous incidents of cheating earlier. Yeah, there had been previous incidents of cheating with the White Sox. So in 1917, there was an incident where he and Swede allegedly collected money from their teammates to pay off a couple of Detroit Tigers players to win the AL championship.
Huh.
That incident was investigated in 1927 by Commissioner Landis 10 years later, but they couldn't gather enough evidence to take any action on any of them. And it was kind of a moot point because those guys were already kicked out of professional baseball anyway. But they did look into it, and it's pretty accepted that probably did happen.
Hmm.
Allegedly.
Probably allegedly.
In September of 1919, Gandia was approached by Sport Sullivan. Sullivan told him that he'd pay $10,000 each per player that Chick could recruit into the scandal to throw the World Series.
Which is the meeting we see at the beginning of the film, essentially, in the restaurant there.
Correct.
Yeah.
Chick himself was supposedly paid $35,000 for his role, though he denied being paid that much money and actually went more towards what we see in the movie where they kind of get stiffed, where they don't make the money that they were supposed to make through the
scam. Right, because the gamblers have it all out on bets, and so they can't keep up their end of the bargain, yeah.
Right.
Especially when when the Sox win game three, and then all of a sudden the gamblers are like, that was the money we were supposed to play the players for game four, and we just lost it because they won game three.
Right, right. So, like we see in the movie, they basically get caught. They go to trial, get acquitted. After he leaves the major leagues in 1920, he goes back to California. Well, actually, it was before they got acquitted because the trial was in 1921. So after the 1919 World Series, he leaves Chicago, goes to California, comes back to Chicago in 1921, stands trial, gets acquitted, then goes back out west to play for semi-pro teams in California. California, Arizona, New Mexico, plays for a few different teams. Actually, several of his teammates from the White Sox that got kicked out of Major League Baseball go with him to play in these desert leagues because it was kind of the only, well, pun intended, it was the only game in town for them. After retiring from baseball, he moved back to California with his wife and daughter and worked as a plumber and retired in 1954. And then he died in 1970 at the age of 82. In the movie, also from the gambler side, the other person that I did kind of a little bit of research on is Arnold Rothstein. So he's the guy played by Michael Lerner in the movie.
Hulu always looks familiar, but I didn't recognize the name necessarily. Like, I've seen him in a million things, but it wasn't a name I was super familiar with.
Yeah, he's a, you probably don't recognize the name, but if you look up a picture, he's a character actor. You've seen him in a bunch of stuff. So he's the kind of the money behind the whole thing. He's the one where Christopher Lloyd and his buddy are saying, well, we need to find, you know, basically a high roller who can basically get us 70 grand seed money to pay the players off. And then after we get that money to pay the players off, then we can kind of fund the rest of it on our own with our winnings from gambling. So the guy that they get to do that is Arnold Rothstein. Early life, he was born in New York City in 1882, which I think is kind of interesting. In the movie, he's portrayed as quite a bit older than the rest of these guys, like the rest of the players. Yeah. But he's only 6 years older than Chick Gandiel.
Oh, wow, right. The movie makes it look like he's in his 50s or something.
Right, yeah. But he's not that old during this time. He gets his criminal beginnings in the early 1900s when he's pretty young, mostly through gambling and bookkeeping, so illegal gambling. He was the one who put up the money for the, again, allegedly put up the money to fix the 1919 World Series. I don't know if he has any family members out there who are litigious or anything, but yeah, allegedly involved in fixing the 1919 World Series. But that's kind of like just a side note in his criminal activity. So like I said, he came up in the criminal world through gambling and bookkeeping. He was involved. He's probably most famous for the 1919 thing, but afterwards he becomes a major player in organized crime during the Prohibition era.
Oh.
And makes a ton of money from illegal alcohol sales and working with organized crime groups and bootleggers.
So he's almost an Al Capone kind of guy. Wait, wasn't Capone also in Chicago? Or is Rothstein not in Chicago? Is he doing this?
No, guy's in New York.
Yeah, okay.
New York City.
That's why he's checking on the game from the... He has to get the ticker tape version,
right,
of...
Which is actually... I like that you bring that up, because I am remembering that now about how I really liked that was like a cool way for them to show something that you wouldn't even really think about. There's no radio broadcasting yet. You couldn't listen to games on the radio. You definitely couldn't watch them on TV because that wasn't invented yet. But there wasn't even like radio broadcasting from the games. If you wanted to follow the game live, you either had to be there or be like this guy, be rich enough to have someone basically do a teletype, and then he had a guy standing up there, a servant basically, reading the teletype out to like the audience of people that were just like sitting in chairs around the teletype machine while this guy just goes through and reads the updates from the game.
Right, right. Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Which I just thought was like a cool way of seeing kind of a prototype of live sports entertainment from the very, very early days.
Hey, let's run down to the telegraph office. Why? To catch the game.
Right, right. And now it's like, yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think that that's basically 100 years. You go from that to now I carry around a device in my pocket at all times. At any time I want to, I can watch any game of any sport in the entire world.
Yeah.
Except for, I'll go to a brief side note here, except for apparently the Kansas 3A state football championship.
You would have to pay for it. You can still watch
it. I'm not going to do. Which I refuse to do. But yeah, that was an interesting thing to see. And this is going to come out way later, but congratulations to the 2023 Cardinals football team on their state championship.
Yeah, Kansas 3A
first
state
one
champs.
Ever.
Yeah, yes, yep.
So in 1928, as happens with a lot of people that get involved in organized crime, Rothstein is shot and mortally wounded during a poker game at the Park Central Hotel in Manhattan. But he goes out like a true, and I mean this in a very literal sense, like a true gangster. He succumbs to his injuries, but the whole time the cops are talking to him, because he doesn't die right away. The cops are talking to him, trying to figure out who shot him and what for, and he refuses to tell him about it. He knows he's gonna die. I mean, he's mortally wounded, and he's like, no, I'm not talking to you.
I ain't no rat.
I'm not gonna tell you the identity of my shooter, and yeah, just don't worry about it.
So no one was charged with his murder?
No, no one knows who shot him.
What?
I think they'd, like, later on, they kind of had a good idea that it was, like, maybe one of a few guys, but yeah, to this day, nobody knows who killed Arnold Rothstein.
Huh.
So he died in November of 1928. After his death, and this actually kind of ties into some stuff that we talked about before, but after his death, there was a power vacuum because Rothstein, with all of his money, held a lot of control over the street gangs, so like the lower level organized crime in New York. After his death and the subsequent loss of his control over the street gangs, Tammany Hall is like, that's like a fatal blow in Tammany Hall's operation because he was the one kind of keeping the low level street guys in line.
Hmm.
And that then leads directly to Fiorello LaGuardia having his rise and eventual election to mayor in 1933. Like the super famous and beloved Mayor LaGuardia, the guy who LaGuardia Airport is named after.
Right.
Basically, there's a direct line from Arnold Rothstein dying to him being elected mayor and enacting all the reforms and becoming the popular mayor that New York City loves, even today.
Huh. Crazy. Anything else on the gamblers, or can I just kind of...
No. Those were the only ones that I did, like, the deep dive into. There, everyone in the movie is a real person and has a real backstory.
Right. Oh, no, right. We can't deep dive into everybody here.
Right. And for the most part, a lot of them are only, like, they're mostly known for their involvement in the 1919 Black Sox scandal anyway. Like, Christopher Lloyd's character in the movie, he was a baseball player before. I think they even, in the movie, don't they have somebody, like, recognizes him?
Yeah, I think so.
And says, oh, yeah, you know, I used to watch you, or remember when you played or something?
He's like, you're a bum, yeah. Yeah.
So, like, those guys are real, they do exist. But, yeah, we don't have time to dive into all of them, but I just thought that those were probably the most interesting and the ones that had the most to say about them.
But I guess in broad strokes, the movie's fairly accurate with, like you said, the payoffs you've described, the idea that the money couldn't actually get paid to the players as promised because it was tied up into bets. That all is accurate. And I guess then, too, no one ever got in legal trouble, right, for this whole thing? Like, the gamblers never got...
Right.
Yeah. Because, like, the players are acquitted.
Yeah, no one was ever convicted of anything.
The gamblers aren't even on trial.
Right.
Right. Okay. And then, yeah, the guys get banned, ultimately. But, again, the gamblers just kind of keep on business as usual. So the big thing that the film, I mean, there's, like you said, everything's streamlined, but the biggest thing that the film leaves out completely is Eddie wasn't the White Sox best pitcher that year. There was another better pitcher who was out hurt / sick.
Oh, right.
Last name Faber. Basically, I forget the catcher's name, but the catcher said later, if Faber was available, this doesn't happen in the first place because you never would have got him. And without him as the best pitcher, you can't get the deal done. So basically, it was actually Faber being out that's what opened the door to the scandal in the first place. Now, Eddie is the best pitcher remaining, and he's gettable because it's similar to the issues we see in the film with getting screwed over and underpaid for his success. But he wasn't even the best pitcher, and they just left that out of the film completely.
Right. Now, Eddie was, well, I
mean, he's good. He was kind of on his way out. He was the older guy. He was a stud.
He is, even today, one of the best pitchers of all time. But by 1919, he had aged such that he was not as good.
That's right. Yes. Right.
Yeah.
And then Faber was now the new star pitcher. Eddie's still holding on. Is maybe in his peak was better than Faber, but at this point in his career is kind of winding down. But yeah, so that was probably the biggest thing I thought they left out. Another thing that I had forgotten about the film is how, and actually it reminded me a lot of Killers of the Flower Moon, which we've talked about off air, but we will have talked, anyway, it's our next episode, but we've already recorded it.
Yeah.
Is that it's all an open secret. It's like, the whole idea, like in the film, they talk about the odds tank, and everyone starts thinking like, oh, the Reds are actually probably going to win this game, like, that happened. Like, it was kind of an open secret that it might not be on the up and up. Now, that was more kind of with, like, the sports reporters and the gamblers in their world. Everyone was very suspicious and skeptical, even those who weren't, obviously, the people who were involved in what was going on. But even those who weren't involved got wind pretty quick. It tanked the odds, and it kind of wasn't what they thought. The general public, though, wasn't really aware of all that. Like you said, it wasn't like you could watch ESPN and hear the rumors or catch a podcast talking about the controversy. So
yeah, exactly.
Right. The public is just taking it pretty much at face value. Oh, the Sox had a down series. Like even after the fact, the general public is like, man, I can't believe the Sox lost. But there were murmurings from even before game one that a fix might have been in those gambling and media circles. We get a little bit in the film where the players try to like double cross and be like, screw it, they're not paying us off anyway. Let's just try to win the whole thing. And then that's where we get the threats of violence toward the other pitcher in the movie.
Yeah.
And that, it looks like, is from the book. So this is all based off a book of the same name from 1963 that is nonfiction. But the author did say he actually made up that specific direct incident. So in general, there were threats made, but the specific threats are kind of unknown. So the whole mystery guy saying directly to this to the other pitcher, you throw this next game where we kill your wife, that was made up.
Yeah.
But there were threats of violence that were made. We just don't know the exact details.
Well, yeah, you would think that if there was any evidence of that happening, like, that is a crime.
Yes.
So, like, that is something that probably would get you in way more trouble if there was evidence of that actually happening.
Well, but I mean, that's, you still gotta, like, are you, if you're that pitcher, though, and that does happen, though, are you gonna go to the police? Even once the gambling stuff came out.
Right, I'm saying, like, historical, like, no one came out afterwards, like, that.
No, okay, right.
And said, like, oh, yeah, like, they said that they were gonna kill my wife if.
Right.
If I didn't throw the game, yeah.
The other thing, and again, the movie has to rush. So in the film, it almost feels like the series is over, and then immediately they summoned a grand jury to investigate. But like,
oh yeah, it was like 2 years later.
Yeah, or so the grand jury was a year later, but then the trial was 2 years later.
Yeah.
So like all those guys, all the banned guys in the 1920. I even wrote 2020 in my notes. In the 1920 season, they're all playing. They're playing up through September of 2020 when the grand jury is summoned. And then
1920.
Did I say it again?
Yeah.
Yeah. These guys have played baseball September for 2020. 100 years.
They were playing in the COVID league.
Yeah, these guys are mostly immortal, which is really bumming. Which makes getting banned even worse when you're immortal. The 1920 season, they're all still playing. When the grand jury is summoned, that's when Comiskey himself says, I'm suspending these guys while this is being sorted out. And Comiskey did very much kind of side with baseball throughout the whole thing. Because again, and you'll talk about him some more, but like from his point of view, he's got to protect the game more than he's got to protect his awesome team that he has right now. So then they're suspended. And then it's still another year. They're basically suspended indefinitely. So then that's the grand jury decides it's going to go to trial. Trials, and then in summer of 21 into the next season, now they haven't played since the fall of the previous year. Oh, but they were like in the pennant race in September of 1920. And he pulls them anyway because he didn't have to. The league didn't step in and say, you got to suspend these guys, because you could also say like, hey, I'm going to wait and see how this ball plays out. Well, maybe it's all just a shakedown, whatever. But he suspends them. They lose the pennant race because of it. And then, yeah, they are acquitted after the trial in 1921. But again, I feel like in the film, it just feels like that all happened bam, bam, bam. But it really was a two-year process from the end of the series they threw to them getting banned for life by new commissioner Landis. I did it every... I mean, it's funny, it's in my notes here. September 2020, summer of 2021. But then I do later write ahead of 1921 season. So I was very inconsistent with that. So one thing I had read, too, that Chick had, you talked about, that Chick had reportedly told Sports Illustrated in the 1950s that he actually did regret the whole thing and said that their ban was justified. But then he supposedly claimed that they bailed on the deal, and it wasn't like threats of violence that got them to continue to throw the... Basically, they were so nervous at that point. He said, like, All these eyes were on us thinking we're throwing the series, and that's pressure is what caused us to mess up and lose the rest of the games. Like, the first two we threw,
and then
we just kind of like choked I hate that term, but like then we kind of just choked the rest of the games after we were trying to double cross the gamblers. But, you know, we'll never actually know, I guess. It's also possible that the term Black Sox was used occasionally before the scandal. And not just because of the other things you were talking about with them trying to get those Detroit guys to throw a game, but it ties into Comiskey being a tightwad, which we see in the film. And that, and this may be more apocryphal, but I still thought it was a fun story, that Comiskey was too cheap to pay for laundering the players' jerseys and said they needed to wash their own jerseys.
That's true.
Okay, that was true. They show them dirty jerseys, and so they call them the Black Sox.
Yes. Okay, I didn't know that that was one of the reasons why they were called the Black Sox. But okay. The thing about Comiskey being super cheap and making them launder their jerseys themselves, that is true.
That's funny. Actually, why don't you talk about Comiskey here then for a little bit and his role in all this as the owner?
So I'll go back and talk about the early Comiskey stuff. But while we're talking about jerseys, there what year was the Chicago Fire?
1871.
Okay, there was a team. I don't remember if it was the team that became the White Sox, or no, I guess it would have been the team that became the Cubs, I think, which was also called the White Stockings before the White Sox were.
That's confusing. Yeah.
Neither here nor there. But anyways, that team after the fire, all of their stuff was destroyed and they had to play all their road games with borrowed jerseys.
Oh, huh.
That was just a little like side story thing that I read while I was reading this stuff.
Of course, when you're still in the Wild West, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. So Charles Comiskey, or Commie Comiskey, also called the Old Roman. He's in the movies played by Clifton James.
Another guy I recognize.
The owner of the team.
This cast is full of recognizable faces. Like, it's crazy.
Oh, man.
There's almost not a person you don't recognize.
Yeah.
Like, even the pitcher's wife I mentioned who gets threatened. Like that's Nancy Travis. Like.
Yeah. And, like, even the small, like, bit roles. Like, the two gamblers that have, like, less than 5 minutes of screen time. Like, one of them is Christopher Lloyd, right?
Well, the other one, the other one's the guy that is the valet driver that takes Ferris Bueller's car, or I guess Cameron's dad's car,
yeah,
and drives it around. That's the same guy. Like, you see him, he's another character actor you see everywhere.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. The cast in this movie rules. So Commie Comiskey, he was born in Chicago in 1859. Early in his life, he actually went to St. Mary's College in St. Mary's, Kansas.
Oh, huh.
And played baseball there. Yeah, played baseball in college, played professional baseball after college, also while working as a plumber, working construction, and driving a brick wagon.
Well, so he's kind of a rags to riches guy then. I wonder if that's why he's a little tighter with money. Like, he didn't grow up with any, apparently.
Maybe. I don't know. In his professional career, he started as a pitcher, but then because of some injuries and stuff, he moved to play first base. And actually innovated the position of the first baseman, choosing to play closer to second base rather than what was called hugging the first base line.
Because no one hits down that line anyway.
Right. Allowed him to field more like infield balls than a traditional first baseman who would basically just stand on first base the entire time. And something that I thought was interesting, he was a manager of the team while also playing.
Super common back then.
So he would manage the team. Yeah. I had no idea. Because today you think about like managers, that's like its own big thing. But this dude was managing and playing first base, which I just thought was kind of interesting. He played for several teams throughout his career, including the St. Louis Browns, the St. Louis Brown Stockings. Which is the organization that is now the Cardinals.
Okay.
So there's a direct lineage there. The Chicago Pirates, that organization no longer exists. And the Cincinnati Reds, who are still the Cincinnati Reds. From all the way back in the 1800s.
Oh, wow. They are the oldest team in professional baseball, though, right? The Reds?
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. Okay. Because he's playing, this would be the 1870s, 1880s. And he's playing for the Reds, and that's still the Reds. So, I mean, that can't... If they're not the oldest team, there can't be teams that are that much older than them.
They are the one team that goes back to the 1869 founding that MLB considers the beginnings of professional baseball in the United States, which is basically the year the Red Sox...
Okay.
Sorry, not the Red Sox. The Cincinnati Red Stockings, which become the Reds, not the Reds that... Sox.
Right.
Anyway. Cincinnati Reds are, the oldest team. Jumping in here while I'm editing, it's not that simple. It sounds like the Reds themselves do claim to be the oldest team, but the organization wasn't continually operated from that initial founding. It may technically be a different franchise with the same name. The Atlanta Braves are often credited as being the oldest continuous running franchise. It's actually up for debate, apparently.
Let's see. So in 1894, he retires from baseball, leaves Cincinnati, and buys the Sioux City Cornhuskers and moves them from Iowa to Minnesota and renames them the St. Paul Saints. He then, after a few seasons there, moves that team to the south side of Chicago in 1900 and renames them the White Stockings as an AL team. And this is where I said that, so the team that became the Cubs, they're an NL team, and they were also called the White Stockings.
Right. And just to add to more confusion here, actually, I don't think the Cincinnati Red Stockings are the ones that still exist today. Anyway, it's confusing. I'm not going to look into that right now, but it looks like that's not the team that still has continued to exist to today. The Cincinnati Reds go back to 1890. Anyway.
Yeah, there's so much there was so much like switching and swapping right back then. Just like with the I like briefly, because I was confused. I was like, wait, they're the White Stockings, but the Cubs were also right. The White Stockings before, but that's a completely different team in a completely different league. And I guess the history isn't even 100% known. Like it's even today the history is hazy on how you go from the NL team being the White Stockings and then becoming the Cubs. And like there were some seasons where they would like different names would be used in the papers for the same team. It was all kind of weird and nebulous back then. It wasn't like today where it's like you have the team and that's the team name and they're, you know, that team with their logo. It was a little bit more loosey-goosey.
The most recent example of that we get is like the Browns-Ravens thing. So like the current franchise, the Baltimore Ravens, was the Cleveland Browns. The Cleveland Browns from like the 80s or whatever moved to Baltimore and were renamed the Ravens. And then a expansion team in Cleveland is also then the Browns. But then they also said the Ravens are a new franchise and the Browns get the old Browns records as far as that franchise. So like it's all, that's kind of complicated and fairly recent.
Right, which is, that's so strange.
Right. It was basically a deal when they left that like, hey, we're actually going to leave the franchise behind and rebrand and start fresh. The Ravens are a new team. And then, yeah, so it's fairly complicated, but basically back 100 years ago, everything was like that.
Right, yeah. So as the owner of the White Sox, he oversaw the building of Comiskey Park, the old one, although the field that they play in now is also or was called Comiskey Park when it was built, although now it's called something else, some dumb corporate name.
Yeah.
And which
that makes me so mad.
By the way, I hate that so much.
I know.
Because you have these stadiums and they change names like every 2 or 3 years to some other dumb corporate name.
Oh, right. I don't even know what the Broncos Stadium is called anymore. I don't even know.
Yeah.
But I don't care.
Yeah. Or like the Chiefs, it's not Arrowhead Stadium anymore.
Right.
It's like something, it's like insert corporate name at Arrowhead.
Right.
It's like, it's so stupid. And like, there's nobody values the like, I just wish these giant corporations, like you can own the stadium, make all the money from it you want. That's fine. I'm good with that. But like, you can't just like, you know, give a little nod to tradition and like name it what it's been called for however many years before.
Right.
It's just so
it's
bland and dumb.
I understand why they're doing it, but they shouldn't. The team shouldn't even allow them to do it. I forget who it was that joked that like at some point, I don't know if it was CGP Grey or someone else, but like at some point it's like you're just gonna have everything, and it's like the Coca-Cola Pacific Ocean. Like everything is just gonna be branded and paid for.
Yeah. So. Yeah, he oversaw the building of Comiskey Park, and the new stadium they play was also named after him. While he was the owner, the White Sox were the AL champs 5 times, including in 1919, which we see at the beginning of the movie, them winning the 1919 AL pennant. The White Sox also won 2 World Series under Comiskey's ownership in 1906 and in 1917. We talked earlier about him being stingy. That is accurate. His players were not paid nearly what they were worth. He did actually bench Eddie Seacote to keep him from winning the 30 games and getting his $10,000 bonus. That is accurate. As well as the scene at the beginning where they show up and they're like, oh, wow, you know, Mr. Comiskey got us this champagne. How nice of him.
It's flat.
And they're like drinking the champagne. Right, right. And the guy says, oh, yeah, so what about our bonuses? And the guy's like, this is your bonus. And they're like, oh, this is flat. Like, he got his team flat champagne as a bonus for winning the AL championship.
When they're expecting cash.
Yeah.
That was real? That's crazy.
That's real. Yeah, that's a real story. So even though he was super stingy, he did actually provide the players with legal representation during their trial. So that bill for their lawyers was footed by Comiskey.
Okay.
But on the flip side, he also supported them getting banned from professional baseball. So like you said, he kicked them off the team basically in 1920. 20 or 21?
20, because that's when the grand jury was in September of 20, yeah.
Right, yeah, in 20 after the grand jury. And then he supported Commissioner Landis's decision to ban them from professional baseball. So it was like a, I don't know, history's complicated. So like he didn't want to see his guys like just get
railroaded,
get you know, an unfair shake in court. So he paid for them to have lawyers, but he personally was in favor of them. Even if he wasn't in favor of them going to jail for it, he was in favor of them never playing professional baseball again.
Again, he saw the big picture ultimately. Like, he understood that, like, yeah.
Yes. After the 1917 World Series, which was the last one that they won, the White Sox never won another World Series under Comiskey. And they actually didn't win another World Series until 1959. So it was a pretty long dry spell. And then Comiskey himself died in 1931 at the age of 72. And if you want to visit his grave, he is buried in Evanston, Illinois, which is like just outside of Chicago.
Okay. So, yeah, let's do Shoeless Joe Jackson, who, again, doesn't actually have a major role in this one. I think part of it in the we might run out of time to talk about Field of Dreams in any kind of detail here. But I did rewatch Field of Dreams before we got on to record here as well. So Shoeless Joe was born in 1887 in South Carolina. To give us some context, he's actually just 3 months older than Jack Reed from Reds. So they're very much contemporaries.
Oh, okay.
Joe's dad was a sharecropper. And my note here was that I'm kind of confused how that's any different than like a medieval serf, where you just kind of like live on the land and farm it, but you don't own it. And you give a cut to the person who actually owns it. Like, how is a sharecropper any different than a serf?
In practice, not really. Okay. I guess the only difference is that technically you're not allowed to like just execute a sharecropper if you're the person that owns their field. Whereas, you know, if there's a serf and like the noble that owns your land, like he has like legal authority over you and could just kill you whenever he wants for no reason.
There's no prima nocta with sharecroppers.
Yeah. Yeah.
When Joe was 10, he almost died of the measles, like was paralyzed and in bed for 2 months, kind of almost died when he was 10.
Oh, wow.
Again, kind of another connection to Reds and stuff. Like, Joe was kind of one of the child laborers that people like Reed wanted to protect. He was working 12-hour days in a textile mill as like a 7 and 8-year-old. Like, it was rough. So he was completely uneducated, like they show in the film. He was illiterate. His wife would later sign things like memorabilia and stuff would be like signed by his wife, not by Joe. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. Later when they were out at like restaurants and stuff, he would just wait as his teammates ordered and just be like, yeah, that sounds good. Because he couldn't read the menu. He started playing ball when he was 13, or I mean, probably before that. But like when he was 13, he started playing for the Textile Mills baseball team. A lot of company, again, you kind of see that today with company softball teams, but back then it was like, the company baseball team wasn't necessarily too much different than the pro teams on some of these.
Yeah, you join the team for the textile mill, and like your season opener is like the Chicago White Sox.
Right. I mean, that's probably less crazy than it sounds, but yeah, not exactly that, but yeah, it's not probably too far removed from that. But
yeah.
So even as a young teen here, he's like quickly the best player on the Mills team. Starts out as a pitcher, and he has such a strong arm that he broke a batter's arm with a pitch one time, so they moved him to outfield.
Oh, wow.
Becomes a local legend for his hitting ability. People quickly start comparing him to other guys who had gone pro. And again, this is all while he's like, you know, 14, 15 years old. He bounces around to better and better teams, and by the time he's 18, he is playing semi-pro ball. The Shoeless story is very much as they describe it in Field of Dreams. He was wearing some new cleats that were giving him blisters, so he took them off mid-game because they were hurting his feet. What I had read online said a fan called him you shoeless son of a gun. Field of Dreams said it was the other players that called him shoeless, but whatever it was, the name stuck. So it wasn't like he always played without his shoes. It was one game and then a nickname that stuck.
Yeah.
But he was called Shoeless Joe for that. He was kind of inconsistent, I guess, and bounced around the minor leagues, and maybe it was just because he was struggling to adjust socially with his background. I'm not exactly sure. But his first, and he played a few games, but his first was considered his rookie season was 1911, and he was 24 years old. What's crazy is he still holds the rookie record for hitting percentage, because he batted .408 as a rookie in 1911.
Jeez.
And actually, I'm pretty sure I read he was second in the batting title to Ty Cobb. I'm pretty sure it said his .408 is the only above .400 hitting percentage to not win the batting title ever. And it was when he was a rookie behind Ty Cobb winning it that year. Let's see. So he's traded to the White Sox in 1915. 2 years later, he helps them win the 1917 World Series. He actually missed most of the 1918 season due to World War I. I think he stayed stateside, but was working in like a shipyard, just kind of helping during the war effort there. He continued to play great baseball through the 1919 and 1920 seasons until he was suspended and then ultimately banned for life as he was caught up in the Black Sox scandal. His involvement in the scandal is still debated to this day. There are still people that want to get him and Buck reinstated posthumously. Buck's probably not a Hall of Fame level player, but Joe Jackson is.
100%.
And people still want to get him exonerated to get him into the Hall of Fame. But he's just not allowed. So the film shows him definitely not going to the meetings, which that's been testified to. He did not attend any of the meetings. Joe did not meet any of the gamblers. The film shows him taking the money and doesn't want to get in trouble, but they kind of convince him because he's dim-witted that, like, hey, you need to take this money so we know you're one of the guys, all that kind of stuff, social peer pressure. There's actually no evidence that he took the money at all. Like, there's, like, other players that said they tossed it on his floor so they could say they gave it to him, but, like, we, again, kind of like you were saying with a lot of stuff, we don't really know 100%, but it's very possible he never took a dime and never had a meeting and never played bad at all. Like, so basically, so there's a pretty good case. So like if Buck we'll talk about, at least Buck was at the meetings and didn't turn the guys in. You can see getting banned for that. But like Joe might not have been involved at all. I guess you could say he also knew, but just from hearsay, he wasn't at the meetings like Buck. He's just hearing rumors. Like he's not necessarily any more, he's potentially not any more culpable than their coach.
Right. Well, and depending on how much he even like heard or what rumors he heard or what the things were that he overheard, he might not have put it together what was actually going on. I mean, it's entirely possible that even if he did overhear some stuff that like to one of the other players might have been like, oh, well, yeah, you know, you said that in front of Joe, and so surely he knows what's happening.
Right.
But it's entirely possible that he just had no idea.
Right. So it's basically like the other players who were in on the fix, they just really needed to include Joe for gambler's peace of mind. Because it's like, well, if you don't have Joe Jackson, then why are we even giving you any money? Oh, we got Joe. Give us some money for Joe. Like, they needed to include him so that the gamblers would buy it, essentially. But again, he played great batting average, no errors. Technically, his batting average was slightly lower in the games they lost, but like within normal realms, like it was still above 300, like, it wasn't significantly different than the games they won. He played great. There's nothing you can point to that says he was throwing the series in any way, shape, or form. Efforts to get him reinstated have obviously been unsuccessful. Basically, the MLB's stance to this day with issues like this are just like, hey, we're not relitigating the past. That was so long ago. We're just wiping our hands of it. It would be arrogant of us to assume we know more than they knew on the ground at the time back in the situation. So, which, I don't know. They're just choosing not to deal with it because I think they probably feel like it would open a can of worms. And like subsequent, like every new commissioner, it gets re-brought up. Like for decades, every time there's a new commissioner, people are trying to go back to bat for Joe Jackson and Buck Weaver that we'll talk about. So after the scandal, he did play semi-pro ball under false names, as they show at the end of the film. I don't know about that particular scene we see at the end of the film, which is another kind of cool moment in the stands there, where it's like 1927 or something, and the guy's saying it looks like Shoeless Joe, and then Buck's in the stands, says, nah, that's not him. Those guys are all gone. Almost a little hokey, but also kind of neat. Little button to the scene there.
Yeah, but it was, you know, that movie was made in 1988. Yeah, like, no, I forgive a little bit of hokiness for it being, you know, 35 years old.
No, it's, yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It isn't quite cross that line, but it's, yeah. So, yeah, then Joe and his wife opened a dry cleaning business at first, and then a barbecue joint, and then later a liquor store. I think this is all down back in South Carolina where he's from. And then he died of a heart attack in 1951 when he was 64. He and his wife never had kids of their own, but they did raise a couple of his nephews. And then another story that's worth mentioning is apparently Ty Cobb at one point goes into the liquor store like with a sports writer. Like they intentionally went down there to go visit Joe Jackson in his liquor store, and it's Ty Cobb and a sports writer there. And Joe just like doesn't there's no sign of recognition at all. Like he's just helping him like any other customer. And then finally, as he's like checking out, Ty Cobb's like, "Don't you know me, Joe?" And then Joe said, and this is just a quote online here, "Sure, I know you, Ty, but I wasn't sure you wanted to know me. A lot of them don't." So I feel like if you look at the two movies, the Field of Dreams version of Joe Jackson that we get from Ray Liotta, it's a fun performance. That just doesn't seem to be who Joe Jackson was at all.
The 8 Men Out one seems a lot closer.
I would agree. I don't know if he was as dim. I mean, yes, he was illiterate, but I don't know if he was as dim outside of being illiterate. I mean, you can be street smarts and illiterate. Like, they almost made right. He's probably not as dumb as they show him in 8 Men Out either. It's probably somewhere in between.
Right.
I do like the line, though, that kind of summed it up in 8 Men Out when the players are making fun of Hap, Charlie Sheen's character, and they basically are like, "Hey, Joe's just ignorant. Hap is dumb." Which I thought was a fun distinction. Yeah, so that's Shoeless Joe Jackson. Again, they talk about him in Field of Dreams quite a lot. Like the whole idea of if you build it, he will come, is that he builds the whole ball field thinking that that means Shoeless Joe Jackson. Shoeless Joe Jackson is the first player that shows up. So, and actually the book Field of Dreams is based off of is called Shoeless Joe. So,
oh really?
It definitely goes. Yeah, it definitely goes into all that. Buck Weaver, way less kind of known about him or written about him than Joe. His name is actually George Weaver, born in Pennsylvania, 1890. The nickname Buck, again, it's kind of interesting. I was kind of trying to do a little deep dive. I couldn't find anything great necessarily, but all the uses of Buck, you know, pass the buck stops here, buck up, young buck, you know, bucked off a horse, you know, calling dollars bucks, all that kind of stuff is the same word. And it does all seem to ultimately go back to the word for male deer and the idea of bucking up, or they call it basically he gets nicknamed Buck because he's happy and energetic. You had a lot of spirit.
Right.
And so you're like a male deer running ramping around the forest. You're a buck. So that's kind of where the nickname comes from. And that's the player he was. So actually the one thing they actually get wrong, I would say, about Buck Weaver in the film is he seems very upset, rightfully so, at his teammates in the film because he was also not throwing the series. He didn't take any money. He was just at the meetings and basically said, "Yeah, you guys do what you want to do. I'm going to play ball." But he's the kind of guy that did it with a smile on his face the whole time. Like it was written about at the time that the whole series they lose the series 5-3 because it was best of 9. He's smiling the whole time, making plays, smile on his face the whole time. So in the film, it's throwing the hat, frustration,
he's
yelling at his teammates.
Mopey and angsty.
Right.
And
that's not who Buck was. Yes, he was competitive, super competitive, but it was with a smile. He was just out there having fun, and even the guys throwing the series didn't knock the smile off his face, according to like beat writers at the time. Yeah, they called him Chicago's one hero during the series. As good as Joe Jackson plays, Buck was, because of his spirit too, like was just kind of very much a team leader. And everything else in the scandal pretty much goes down like you see in the film. He was known most for his fielding. We kind of see that with him playing third base. He was supposedly, so Ty Cobb was the best player in the league at this time. he's referenced in Field of Dreams as well, because Joe says they didn't invite him on purpose because none of them liked him. Buck Weaver was supposedly the only player in the league that Ty Cobb wouldn't try to bunt toward, because you'd get thrown out if you're bunting to Buck Weaver. Like, he just had that hustle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, then the scandal kind of goes down as is. I didn't see anything about him being frustrated during the trial and making a big fuss. Like you said, John Cusack's role is he does a great job. But I couldn't see anything about him raising a fuss or wanting a separate trial and like all that kind of stuff and getting his teammates to say, yeah, no one cares about your batting average, Buck, sit down. Like, I didn't see anything about that being true. But not that it wasn't, but it just also doesn't seem to fit his personality. Although, he did sue Comiskey for his lost salary during the 1920 and 21 seasons when he was suspended before he was banned.
Yeah.
He sued for the salary he missed by getting suspended, and Comey had to pay. The court said, yep, you owe Weaver that salary. You shouldn't have suspended him.
Oh, was it because, like, there was no...
There was no ruling yet, yeah.
Was it because he right, there was no ruling, so technically Comiskey suspended him for no reason.
Right, right.
Well, not for no reason.
Well, no, right, right.
Prematurely suspended him prior to there being a ruling and having evidence presented.
Right, right. So the court ruled Comey had to pay back pay to Buck. But yeah, and then efforts to clear him have failed. So at the risk of going long here, what about Eddie Seiko? Did you have anything on Eddie?
Yeah. So Eddie, actually a pretty interesting career. So Eddie, he is the pitcher in the movie played by David Strathairn. This might be the youngest David Strathairn I've seen in a movie.
Oh, it's fun to see. I love him as an actor. And honestly, though, it probably goes back to watching him when I was 10 in this. But yeah.
Yeah, he's so good. He was born in 1884 in Michigan.
Eddie Seiko, not David Strathairn. Sorry.
Yeah. Eddie Seiko. Started in the minor leagues in Georgia in 1905. He and Ty Cobb both got called up to the majors the same year and both played for the Tigers at the same time. So he was actually teammates with Ty Cobb early in his professional career. He finished pitching finished that season, but he didn't play in the majors again until he started pitching for the Red Sox in 1908. And he played there for four seasons till he was picked up by the White Sox in 1912. He is famous, just like we see in the movie, for his knuckleball, and was even nicknamed Knuckles. He might have even been the person to invent the pitch. With this early baseball stuff,
it's hard to say who popularized versus who invented. Yeah.
Right. There were innovations that were happening where it's like, you know, you would have a couple pitchers who started pitching knuckleballs around the same time, but it's not 100% known who was the one to do it first. But it's very possible that he was a person to invent the knuckleball pitch. For listeners or viewers now who don't know what a knuckleball is, it's basically a method of pitching where you hold the ball like with your fingertips or like with your fingernails even, and it's pitched in such a way that it has no spin, and so that causes the air flow over the surface of the ball to be more turbulent, and it makes it kind of like
a wobble,
wild and erratic.
Yeah,
it doesn't,
yeah.
Right, it wobbles around. So it's hard to anticipate where you need to put your bat to swing to be able to hit it.
It's hard to throw, though, right? I think. I mean, like, you don't see it a lot because it's hard to throw.
Yeah, it's hard to throw, but for pitchers like Eddie Seacote, if you can get it down, it can be like really, really advantageous for a pitcher to be able to throw a good knuckleball like that, and which he was. So in 1913, he had a really, really good season. So that was his second season with the White Sox. He had an 18-11 record, but he really crushed it in 1917. That was his best season ever, at least in terms of his earned run average. It was his lowest ERA ever. He had 28 wins that season, and he led the league in innings pitched and in wins. And just because I'm going to bring it up several more times, an earned run average, it's a statistic in baseball for pitchers. Basically, you take 9 times the number of runs that pitcher earns against them, and then you divide it by the number of innings that they pitch.
Right, so the lower, the better.
So the lower the number, the better, right. In 1917, on April 14th, he pitched a no-hitter against the St. Louis Browns, which, like I said before, that's the Cardinals now. He did struggle with injuries, like we see in the film, towards the end of his career, but he did manage to win 29 games in 1919 before being benched on purpose by Comiskey.
Sorry, just do the math for me real quick. So how old was Eddie in the 1919 season?
So he would have been, let's see, he was born in 1884, so he would have been 35.
Okay, yeah.
So, again, he's not, like, super old.
Well, but also you think players play older now. 35 was probably, like, 45 back then.
Yeah, 35 is pretty old. And you have to think about, like, there was no, like, recovery science back then. I mean,
right.
we see it in the movie. He's basically going home and his wife is just kind of like rubbing his shoulder a little bit. He's like, oh, well, yeah, I guess I'm good to go now.
Right.
I'm going to go pitch some more innings in the professional baseball game. Yeah, these guys were getting torn up. They were getting absolutely torn up. When he was first approached by Chick Gandil in the 1919, at the end of the 1919 season, to throw games for money, he refused. And he kept refusing all the way up until Comiskey refused to give him the bonus. So he kept trying to get the bonus from Comiskey, kept trying to make his case like, hey, you benched me. I would have won at least one of those games that you benched me for. I won 29 games. You need to give me the bonus. And Comiskey kept saying no, no, no. And so then he says, all right, Chick, I'm in. I need the money. After they lost the series, Seacoat was the first player to confess that he was involved in the scandal, and was initially given immunity, though he later recanted his confession.
Because they were lost, like the film kind of shows. They disappeared. And so he's like, oh, okay, I didn't confess then.
Right, yeah. In the trial, he was acquitted along with everyone else, but was banned, and afterward returned to Michigan, where he managed a gas station, and then he was a game warden, and then he worked in a Ford automobile factory. He retired and then lived on a strawberry farm until his death in 1969 at the age of 84. Real fast, before we move on from Eddie Seacoat, just statistically, this is just something that I thought was kind of fascinating. So he is, even to this day, one of the best pitchers of all time. He holds the 291st, 243rd, 152nd, 133rd, 54th, and number 44 best pitching seasons of all time as far as ERA is concerned. So in 1913, which was, I said, that was his second season at the White Sox where he really started to shine, he had an ERA that year of 1.578. And in the 1917 season, which was his best season, he had an ERA of 1.532. For reference, the lowest ERA from the 2023 season was Blake Snell from the Padres. He had an ERA of 2.25.
Which is awesome. Now, was he that good compared to the other dead ball era pitchers, though? Because if the baseball was different, they did say that was kind of an era dominated by pitchers. But to your point, he was still better than the other pitchers at the time.
Yeah, he still... So in the 1917 season, he had the lowest ERA of any pitcher in the league.
Yeah, okay. It gets a little tricky with the changes in the baseball. But point taken. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And actually, I think in 1913, he didn't have the lowest, but I think he was a runner-up. He had like the second lowest ERA that season.
Okay. So consistently a league leader in ERA. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I just thought that was crazy. He's still number 44 all time for lowest season ERA.
Yeah. Kind of like Joe with the batting average stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So finally here, we're kind of running out of time, so this is probably the last person we talk about, is Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis. And I'm gonna throw him out there as, if I had to pick one person from this film to be our candidate for most interesting person in American history, because we will probably do a tournament after this timeline is completed, I would nominate Landis. So I don't know if there was a Civil War baby boom per se, but Landis was born in 1866 in Ohio. His father was wounded at the Battle of Kennesaw Mountain, although I think I saw one account, maybe it was his grandfather, but anyway, so there's a family connection to the Battle of Kennesaw Mountain, and hence his name. His dad was a doctor. They later moved from Ohio to Indiana, while Kenny, they called him Kenny, was still a kid. He left school at 15 because he sucked at math, and just kind of bounced around a bunch of odd jobs. But what he fell into that he really enjoyed was a shorthand reporter for a county court. So that's kind of how he gets into like the legal world initially, as a court reporter. He was also, though, a good athlete. He was like a good bicycle racer. And those are those early days of the bicycle we've talked about. He was also a baseball player. Reportedly was offered a contract to go pro, but turned it down because he said he just preferred to play for the love of the game. Which, I mean, I didn't... Where I read that, they didn't necessarily challenge the veracity of that, but I almost feel like that's something someone says that didn't actually get offered to go pro. But who knows? Who knows? He is kind of an interesting guy, though, that was very principled, and that also kind of would fit his character. In his early 20s, he got an entry-level government job, and while he was working there, he applied to be an attorney because that's all it took then in Indiana, just apply to be a lawyer. The criteria at the time were... One, be 21 years old. Two, be of good moral character. That's it. That's if you want to be a lawyer, those are the criteria.
Sweet. I want to go be a lawyer.
Well, if you want to go back to the 1890s in Indiana, yes, you can. But he did still then start going to law school after he was already an attorney, because it was, you kind of still, people didn't want to necessarily hire you if you didn't have the background. But anyway.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. You could have the title,
right?
Lawyer, attorney, all you want, but if you don't know anything about practicing law, you're probably not going to get very many clients.
Exactly. So yeah, kind of that. So he started, and of course, again, it's just crazy how different it is of a time this. So he starts attending law school in Cincinnati at the YMCA. The 19th century was such an interesting time. So, but yeah, from the YMCA law school in Cincinnati, he does go to Union Law School, which was either part of or became Northwestern University. And then he graduates, he gets his law degree from there at 25 years old in 1891 and was admitted to the Illinois Bar. He stays on teaching at Union, where he was friends with one Clarence Darrow, the lawyer from the Scopes Monkey trial.
The Scopes Monkey trial.
And then 2 years later, he actually goes to D.C. to work for the U.S. Secretary of State, which is basically a gig he gets because that Secretary of State was another Illinois, Indiana guy who knew Landis from all their time here at, you know, in these local, more local jobs. And so he goes to D.C. to work for that guy. President Cleveland actually offers him, the Secretary of State dies, and President Cleveland actually offers Landis to be the ambassador to Venezuela. But he turns it down and instead just goes back to Illinois to get married and practice law, which I kind of get. It's like if you're, he's in his you know, late 20s. And it's like, hey, do you want to go to Venezuela? No, I want to go home and get married and start a family or whatever instead. So he does that. He's very successful in corporate law. Teddy Roosevelt was a big fan of his. They're kind of tackling a lot of these same early, you know, monopoly cases and stuff, trust busting and stuff. Landis is kind of on Teddy Roosevelt's side of all that. So Roosevelt promotes him to a U.S. District Court position in 1905. He's kind of just a no-nonsense guy with a sharp wit. And so his courtrooms, wherever Judge Landis was, it was never boring. Like, people would just go, hey, what are you doing today? I'm going to go to the courthouse and just sit in and see what's happening in Landis's courtroom, because it's always interesting. He's just an interesting judge with his sharp wit, known for his integrity. He did oversee a big Standard Oil case when he was on the bench. He was a big baseball fan all throughout. If he wasn't at the courthouse, you could probably find him at a White Sox or a Cubs game. And so, like, that was definitely one of his passions. There was at one point a case he was overseeing involving, like, a rival league. So, like, not the NL or the AL, another league that's trying to get in and, you know, vie for players and all those kinds of things that were happening at the time. And the quote he said at the time was, talking to both sides here, both sides must understand that any blows at the thing called baseball will be regarded by this court as a blow to a national institution. Like, he's just like, don't mess with baseball in my court. Like, that's his thing.
Man, no wonder they made him the commissioner, dude. That's
right. So during World War I, he was also then trying several of the radicals that you hated so much in Reds.
Oh, dude, this guy rules.
Well, I dig him. I dig him.
I'm a big Kenny Landis fan.
So groups like the IWW that we talked about in Reds, they were against the draft. And some of those things ended up in court, and Landis was often then the one kind of in charge of dealing with these people. Now, what's interesting, though, I mentioned integrity, though. So even though he personally didn't care for all these radicals and these people like Jack Reed, Jack Reed himself wrote about how fair Landis was as a judge during these trials. So he's basically, he's having these trials of these anti, basically draft-dodging commie liberals, and Landis is the judge. Jack Reed's writing about how fair it is. And so here's actually something probably unique on our whole timeline here is I'm going to read a excerpt written by Jack Reed, the main character from Reds, about Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis.
Okay.
So it's not super short, but I thought it was so cool that we actually have one character from a movie writing about a character from another movie in real life.
Yeah.
Okay. So here we go. Small on the huge bench sits a wasted man with untidy white hair and emaciated face in which two burning eyes are set like jewels. Parchment-like skin split by a crack for a mouth. The face of Andrew Jackson 3 years dead. Upon this man has devolved the historic role of trying the social revolution. He is doing it like a gentleman. In many ways, a most unusual trial. When the judge enters the courtroom after recess, no one rises. He himself has abolished the pompous formality. He sits without robes, in an ordinary business suit, and often leaves the bench to come down and perch on the step of the jury box. By his personal order, spittoons are placed by the prisoners' seats. And as for the prisoners themselves, they are permitted to take off their coats, move around, read newspapers. It takes some human understanding for a judge to fly in the face of judicial ritual as much as that. So that's what Jack Reed wrote about his time in Landis' court. So it's kind of this interesting mix. He's very smart and sharp-witted and strict, but also he doesn't stand on formality at the same time. And so he's just a cool, no-nonsense, doesn't-suffer-fools kind of person, but no one doubts his integrity. So when you need someone to be the commissioner of baseball and clean up the sport and put a public face to baseball is now clean, this guy was the perfect
guy.
Choice.
Yeah.
Custom made for this job. So a few things are different. So in the film, we see him, they see him approached by the owners, and Landis immediately hits them with like all these demands. And that's mostly true, but the idea of a single commissioner with like all this power, like they had already decided to go away from a commission to one person before they picked Landis. So I forget how the film dealt with that exactly, but I feel like he's the one that said, just me. In reality, the owners said just one guy and then went to Landis, if that makes sense. But he did lay down many strict criteria before he would accept the job. At least one manager at the time, and this fits with everything we just read from Jack Reed, at least one manager compared Kennesaw Mountain Landis to Dickens' character. He's like, the guy is basically right out of Dickens. Like, it makes sense with his big personality, the sharp features. Like, he is a Dickens character.
Yeah.
And then the film doesn't mention this. Of course, it has no reason to. He actually remained a federal judge for a few years while serving as baseball commissioner. Like, he was the commissioner of baseball and still trying cases at the federal level, which a lot of people didn't like, and he ultimately stepped down. But again, in Landis fashion, I'm pretty sure he ignored the complaints at first and then stepped down when it was convenient for him and on his own terms. He's definitely a guy who did things on his own terms.
Right. And I wonder if it's a... Some people might say, oh, that's like inappropriate, or there's like a conflict of interest. But because he is, you know, so honest and has so much integrity, maybe it didn't even occur to him like, oh, I could use this, like use one position to influence the other. Like he, you know, that would have never been anything that he would even remotely consider. So for him, it was like, oh, yeah, I'm just doing two jobs.
Right. And I don't know of any baseball cases coming up again while he's also commissioner of baseball. And again, he's the kind of guy that probably would have recused himself had they come up.
Sure.
So in addition to the 8 Black Sox, he actually also banned an additional 10 players over the years for their roles in smaller gambling incidents. And as much as it seems he's being really harsh with, say, Buck Weaver in particular, that the film kind of shows why Buck, he had nothing to do with it. He didn't take any money. He was mad about it. He played amazing. What we see in the quote, they actually read his ruling. So the boys in the film are celebrating getting exonerated and acquitted in the trial. And then they read Judge Landis's ruling over that celebration that talks about them being banned, that's verbatim. That is word for word the actual ruling that Landis wrote. And basically, yes, anyone who sits, and I didn't pull it up here, but anyone who sits in council and doesn't immediately report them to their club should also be banned. That is actually really important, because banning Buck Weaver is essentially what dried up the gambling scandals, because you now couldn't afford to have any knowledge of it, which means anybody who wants to throw a game, the moment they bring it up to a player they're not certain is going to be in on it, they know that player's going to report them, because if they don't report them, they could get banned for life. And so Buck was basically the sacrificial lamb that had to be killed to save baseball. And so he's almost like collateral damage, I guess, in this kind of muddy, corrupt era, you have to sacrifice Buck Weaver to save baseball. And because it did dry up, like the gambling scandals stopped. I mean, it took years, but like they stopped. Again, nothing's ever perfectly clean, but it wasn't worth the risk anymore for the players to ever actually be in on these scandals. And so it became essentially a non-factor. Landis also he was commissioner until he died in 1944. So 25 years here,
which is crazy.
That's
a crazy, because he was not a young man when became the commissioner of baseball. And then he was a commissioner for over 20 more years.
Right, born in 66, died in 44. Yeah, so whatever that is, 78. The one knock on him though. He gets a lot of criticism still to this day for not integrating baseball, because baseball was integrated not long after he died. He dies in November of 44 after an October 44 heart attack. And then they integrate baseball with Jackie Robinson. Like, it's not long after, but it's also kind of unclear to what extent Landis is just being scapegoated and to what extent he was trying to stop integration. He's on the record as saying that there was no rules against it. He's saying, hey, if the managers want to hire black players and sign black players, they can do it. That's on record. But it could have also been something that was the public statement, and behind the scenes, he was a little more reticent and might have been like putting hurdles in the way. So honestly, I don't know for sure which way to go on this one. It's possible he was a roadblock to integrating baseball. It's equally possible he was truly agnostic and said it was in the owner's hands and that he wasn't going to push it, which you could criticize him for not pushing it as commissioner. That you could argue very easily, and this is a valid criticism, well, you are the commissioner, you could encourage or incentivize integration, and you did not. But again, that's kind of like a person of his time kind of thing, and who knows. So love him or hate him, it's fair to say he did save baseball. So I mentioned he died in November 1944 after a heart attack. They voted him into the Hall of Fame 2 weeks after his death. So this guy just instantly gets enshrined in the Hall of Fame. And yeah, is definitely one of the most important people in the history of baseball, even though he never played or coached. So yeah we kind of went long there. Probably need to go ahead and sign off here. Very glad you enjoyed the movie. This episode is now almost as long as the movie. But yes, thanks for listening or watching if we successfully got this uploaded to YouTube, because I'm still not 100% sure how that's going to work. Our next episode will be one we've already recorded, but you can check it out on wherever you find all your favorite podcasts, and that is the Martin Scorsese film that just came out, Killers of the Flower Moon.